who's not here, for inviting me, inflicting me upon you. I'm going to start with some take-home messages. I've learned that it's always best to start with the conclusions because you never get to the end of your talk. So I'm just going to read these. I'm not going to expound upon them. Hopefully, they will be backed up by the things that I'll say during the talk. So the first message is that the unity of physics demands a space-time approach to quantum foundations. So general relativity teaches us that the nature of the physical world is has a space-time four-dimensional character, and that should be reflected in any approach to the foundations of quantum theory. The second message is that the path integral is the basis of such a space-time approach to quantum mechanics. Following work and developments by Dirac, Feynman, and then in more recent times by Jim Hartle and Raphael Sorkin. The path integral situates quantum theories in a framework that incorporates and extends classical theories. So classical theories are just special cases, revealed to be just special cases of quantum theories. In a path integral approach, the wave function has no fundamental status. It's neither ontic nor epistemic. That is revealed to be a false dichotomy within a space-time path integral framework. Rather, the wave function is a partial summary of enough of the past for future predictions to be able to be made. And as a space-time approach, the path integral is suited, particularly suited to a quantum theory of space-time, in other words, quantum gravity, and that has been pointed out and forcefully by many workers in quantum gravity. I've just picked out a few names here: Hartle, Hawking, Lowell, and Sorkin. Okay, so here are some quotations from a paper that Dirac wrote in 1932. It was published in 33, and the title of the paper is called "The Lagrangian in Quantum Mechanics." So these are all the words of Dirac. "Quantum mechanics was built up on a foundation of analogy with the Hamiltonian theory of classical mechanics. There is an alternative provided by the Lagrangian. There are reasons for believing that the Lagrangian one is the more fundamental." And he gives two reasons. The first reason he gives is that there is no action principle of the Hamiltonian theory. The second reason is that the Lagrangian method can easily be expressed relativistically, while the Hamiltonian method is essentially non-relativistic in form, since it marks out a particular time variable as the canonical conjugate of the Hamiltonian function. So I'm not going to say too much more about the Hamiltonian approach. Suffice it to say that in classical mechanics, in order to define the Hamiltonian, you need to choose a time variable. So here I'm drawing space-time, these are surfaces of constant time. You need to choose that before you can define your canonical conjugate variables, P and Q. They depend on this choice of time, and then the Hamiltonian itself then also depends on that choice of time. So it's essentially non-relativistic. You need a frame to define a Hamiltonian. So phase space is essentially non-relativistic because you need to choose a frame in order to define your phase space, in order to define P, momentum P. Position and momentum are not on the same footing physically, and this is particularly apparent in quantum theory. It doesn't seem to be so, you can't see it so clearly in classical physics, but in quantum physics it has a consequence which you don't actually see in the classical theory. And what in a non-relativistic quantum theory built on the Hamiltonian, this essential non-relativistic nature shows up as non-local signaling. So I'm going to show you what I mean by that now. So let's consider two local measurements of position at two times, minus epsilon and epsilon. So this is t equals 0. And at time t equals minus epsilon, we do a measurement. And the measurement is onto it, the measurement is of a particular observable. And that observable is the particle is in this range of position x. So this is just a one-dimensional non-relativistic particle. So this is time going upwards, and this is position x. Okay. All right, and I'm going to let the projection operator onto the subspace of Hilbert space that corresponds to the eigenvalues of position being in this particular range. I'm going to call that projection operator A. It depends on time. It's a Heisenberg projection operator, so it depends on this time here. Okay, so we do that measurement. And then a second measurement is done, not at time t equals 0, but at time t equals epsilon. Let's do a measurement over here. And this is a measurement of whether or not the particle is in this particular range of position. So it's distinct from this one. So these are in different positions. And I'm going to say the projection operator associated with projecting onto the relevant eigenspace of the Hilbert space at time t equals epsilon is B. Okay, so A depends on minus epsilon, B depends on epsilon. They're projection operators onto this range of position at t equals minus infinity. T equals minus epsilon, and this range of position at t equals epsilon. Okay. Now, it turns out that let's consider now the agent Alia, who can either do this measurement or not. It's up to her choice. An agent Bi over here definitely does the measurement of B. You can calculate the expectation value of the measurement of B if Alia does her measurement, conditioned on her doing the measurement, and calculate the expectation value of B if Alia doesn't do her measurement. And those two expectation values are different. However, if you take epsilon to 0, those two expectation values become the same. So if the times of the measurements become almost coincident, the difference in the two expectation values of this measurement becomes 0. So the signal goes away. So there's no non-local signaling. Alia cannot signal to Bi by doing or not doing this measurement of position. Okay, here I've written in math what I just said. The expectation value of B if Alia doesn't do her experiment minus, this is the expectation value of B if Alia does do her experiment. So it's conditioned on the experiment but not on her outcome. And that difference tends to 0 as you take epsilon to 0. Okay. Now, we can add a measurement in the middle here at time t equals 0. And let's say that measurement is of position again. And it's associated to some range of position here. And the projection operator onto that range of position I'll call C. Okay, so again, Alia either does or doesn't do her measurement. The measurement of C does happen, and then we calculate the expectation value of B. And you can again show that doing this intermediate measurement of C doesn't have any consequence. It doesn't cause any kind of non-local signaling. You can again show that the difference in the expectation value of B conditioned on whether doesn't depend on whether Alia does her experiment. Her measurement of position or not. Okay. Are there any questions about that? I want to contrast that situation with the following. Almost the same protocol. Aliyah either does or doesn't do her her position measurement to see whether the particle is in this range or not. The measurement, the intermediate measurement at time t equals zero, is now not onto a range of is not of a range of position, but actually a range of momentum. So the measurement that's done at t equals zero is a measurement of whether or not the momentum of the particle is in a particular range of momentum, say. And then again, we calculate the expectation value of B conditioned on whether Aliyah does her position measurement or not. So this is a measurement of position. This is a measurement of position, perfectly local. Local agents can do these measurements. But this measurement here, C, is now a measurement of position. And what happened before does not happen now. So the expected value of B actually depends on whether Aliyah does her measurement or not. And that signal doesn't go away as you take epsilon to zero. The signal remains. So if this measurement of momentum is possible, then there's non-local signaling between Aliyah and Bai. So this simple example, this is just a non-relativistic quantum mechanics, so you might not be too worried about non-local signaling. This is signaling. This is not not just non-local influence. It's an actual signal. However, this simple example can be generalized to the context of a relativistic quantum field theory to demonstrate that if you can do, for example, ideal measurements of one particle states, then you can achieve superluminal signaling. Yes.
If you do the same experiment, but instead of position measurement, momentum measurement, is there symmetry between exchanging position?
There is symmetry mathematically. That's true. But you can't even talk about non-local signaling with momentum measurements. So I chose, in order to talk about signaling, I chose measurements that Aliyah can achieve in her lab locally and measurements that Bai can achieve locally in his lab. So to talk about signaling, you need to talk about measurements that you can do locally. So position measurements can be done locally. So this is a position and this is a position. And then we can analyze what different measurements here, what effects they have. But yes, mathematically, if this is a momentum measurement and that's a momentum measurement, I mean, you couldn't even localize it, but if you had a momentum measurement here, momentum measurement here, momentum measurement here, they all commute in the limit when epsilon goes to zero and you would get zero for the difference. Are there other questions? Yes.
So momentum measurement at C kind of implies something with position measurement as well, right? Because you have to localize the thing in order to measure it for momentum.
So I haven't talked anything about how you're going to achieve this at all. So so you can get more or less signaling by choosing a different kind of measurement here. But the one that I described to you where you do a measurement of whether or not the momentum of the particle lies between, say, P1 and P2, such a measurement will cause non-local signaling between Aliyah and Bai.
I was just wondering if there's a get-out due to the uncertainty principle that you are kind of, to know something's momentum, you have to know where to measure the momentum, like you have to know something about the location of the particle to kind of...
So you're trying to bring physics into it now, which is exactly the right the right thing to do. Okay, so this is just showing that the sort of rules, just blindly applying the rules of ideal measurements gets you into trouble if you just blindly apply them without asking how you're going to do the measurement to momentum measurements. Yeah.
But I mean, I guess isn't the logical conclusion that measurement introduces non-locality, that intermediate thing? That's physically that cannot be possible.
Physically that cannot be possible. That's the right conclusion. Yeah. So physically we can't do such a measurement, right? So this simple example and the quantum field theory example show that the beautiful and attractive transformation theory in canonical quantum theory, which says that unitarily related bases in the Hilbert space are equivalent, is ruined. They're not equivalent. They're ruined by physics. And in particular, they're ruined by the law of locality. So this essentially non-relativistic nature of the Hamiltonian approach is revealed whenever measurements are analyzed, because measurements take place in space-time. Okay, so for this and other reasons, let's take the relativistic road at Dirac's fork. So Dirac has set out a fork, a choice to be made, very fundamentally at the very start of in quantum theory. We have a choice between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian. Hamiltonian is non-relativistic, essentially. Lagrangian is relativistic, essentially. So let's take, for the sake of unity, let's take the relativistic road, and let's base quantum mechanics on the Lagrangian. And what does that, where does that lead us? Well, Dirac himself showed where it leads to in that paper, and he showed that it leads to the path integral. And famously, later on, Feynman also wrote a paper called The Space-Time Approach to Non-Relativistic Quantum Mechanics, and it was all about the path integral. Okay. So at a very basic level, the path integral is a way to express the propagator. So in one dimension in for a non-relativistic particle, the propagator, which is the amplitude for the particle to go from a position x at time t to go to x primed at t primed, is given by this sum over paths or integral over paths. So gamma are all the paths that start at xt, end at x prime t primed, and each path is weighted by an amplitude, which is the exponential of I times its action, classical action, over h bar. And for the non-relativistic particle, the action is just the integral of the Lagrangian. Okay, so for the non-relativistic particle, this time, background time, is there, but when you go to the relativistic theory, the Lagrangian is fundamentally covariant and doesn't depend on any background time or any frame. So first of all, what does the Lagrangian do for us? And the Lagrangian and the path integral, what does it do for us? Well, first of all, it gives a reformulation of the textbook quantum mechanics. So it gives a reformulation of the Copenhagen rules for prediction, but without Hilbert space. So you don't have to think about or mention Hilbert space, but you can reproduce the Copenhagen rules for prediction. But more than that, it gives a way to go beyond the textbook. In other words, it gives us a way to formulate quantum theory for closed systems that are in a way that's essentially relativistic. So it's a way to get away from the Copenhagen restrictions that you need classical external measuring devices and observers in order to do physics. So first I'm going to show you how to reformulate the usual rules using the path integral, and then I'm going to tell you how we can go beyond the textbook. Okay. So here's a formula for the textbook result, the textbook prediction, for the probability of a sequence of measurement outcomes. Okay, and those measurement outcomes, so we imagine doing a sequence of measurements at time t1, t2, t3, up to tn, and of some observables. And the outcome of the first measurement I denote as delta 1, and et cetera. And the textbook rule for the probability of this particular sequence of outcomes is the following. You take the state, so this is in the Heisenberg picture, take the state, you project onto the eigenspace, the eigenspace of the Hilbert space associated with this outcome, delta 1, at t1, and similarly at t2, and all the way up to tn. You then take the modulus squared of that, of the state that you end up with, and that's the probability. Okay, and it's a nice three-line calculation to get to this formula. The projection operators are Heisenberg operators, so we can transform this formula to the Schrödinger picture. And in the Schrödinger picture, the formula becomes, well, we take the state at time, an initial time t0, we evolve using the unitary time evolution operator to time t1, we evolve from 0 to t1, we project using the Schrödinger projection operator, evolve from t1 to t2, project using the Schrödinger projection onto the eigenspace associated with delta 2, outcome delta 2, etc. And then finally, at the end, we evolve from time tn to some arbitrary truncation time tn plus 1. Turns out it doesn't matter what that time is. You can choose it, the result doesn't depend on it, but you choose some arbitrary truncation time after the final measurement. You take the modulus squared of that, the norm squared of that state, and that's the probability. Okay, so that's just the textbook. If these measurements are all on measurements of position, so I can use my picture here. So this is t, and let's say this is t equals, sorry, this is t, this is x. So this is t1, this is t2, t3, up to tn plus 1, this is tn. And we have some range at t1 delta 1, some range at t2 delta 2, some range at t3 delta 3, etc. delta n. If they're all measurements of position, and we're asking, does the particle go through, is it in this range at t1, is it in this range at t2, is it in this range at t3? The probability that all those questions have the answer yes is given by that the formula that we just had. And we can use the fact that the propagator is a path integral to find that the probability of the answer yes to all those questions, yes, the particle does go through delta 1, yes, it goes through delta 2, yes, it goes through delta 3, is the following. It's a double sum over history. It's a double path integral. So it's an integral over all histories gamma primed, which are in a certain set. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. And all histories gamma, which are in that same set, weighted by this this integrand, where this set delta is a set of all paths, all trajectories, such that the trajectory at time ti is in the range delta I. So this range ai bi is the range delta I. So it's a set of all histories that start anywhere here, go like this, threading their way through all the ranges and end up here. So you consider all such paths that do go through these ranges, and that's the set delta. And what's the weight, this weight? Well, the weight is, you take, it's the amplitude, the amplitude for gamma primed, complex conjugated, times the amplitude for gamma, times a delta function, which forces the two final endpoints to be the same. So you sum over pairs of paths, gamma, here's another path, gamma primed, and the two final endpoints must be the same endpoint. And the amplitude is for a path, a trajectory, a history gamma, is e to the I times e, the exponential of I times the classical action of that path over h bar, weighted by the amplitude for for its initial position. So these two can be different. So this is the initial position here, gamma of 0, and there's some amplitude for that initial position. Okay. So this is just it's half a page of manipulation of the formula for the probabilities of sequence of outcomes of measurements using these projection operators and using the path integral formula for the propagator to get this. Okay. So that path integral, or sum over histories, gives us what the textbook theory does. So you can calculate probabilities of sequences of outcomes of position measurements just using this path integral. So there's no wave function that's evolving in there at all. And more than that, for non-relativistic quantum mechanics, one can actually construct from this path integral. So you just start with the path integral, you don't mention canonical quantization, you don't mention Hilbert space. You can start with the path integral and you can construct from it rigorously the usual Hilbert space of equivalence classes of square integrable functions, complex functions on the configuration space. The rigorous proof we only have for in the case of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and there are some conditions that have to be obeyed by the propagator. But those conditions are satisfied by a wide class of quantum mechanical models, the free particle, including the free particle and the harmonic oscillator. The wave function doesn't appear here as fundamentally. You can construct the Hilbert space from the path integral, but fundamentally that you can base the theory on the path integral itself. It has no fundamental status, but you can define a wave function as an executive summary of the measurement outcomes up to some time. And one can derive the Schrödinger equation for it. So I'm not going to say anything more about that, but if you want, I can show you more what I mean by that after. Yeah.
So you did have a wave function in the previous slide and somehow disappeared in this slide. So what?
Yes. So I didn't call it a wave function. Yes, yes, all right, I'm not going to. It's some other thing, Kai. It's just a set of amplitudes. Uh-huh. It's not an element of a Hilbert space. It's just a set of amplitudes.
Well, but I mean that's part of that probability, right? So, I mean, could it be not normalizable?
So it's normalized. So yeah.
So then it's a wave function.
Well, yes. I mean, it turns out that it is, but the Hilbert space you can construct. The Hilbert space that you construct is constructed only from this entity, and it doesn't. The usual construction of the Hilbert space is as a representation of the canonical commutation relation. So in that sense, so you don't have anything like that. There's no canonical commutation relations that you need to produce a representation. That you need to produce a representation of. So that's it.
I would have thought the space of chi's is your inverse space, but
right, but you only have one chi. So that's those are the initial amplitudes. You don't ask where they came from. They're just the initial amplitudes. So
you could not have different initials. It's one unique initial.
Right. That, the idea, so roughly speaking, yeah, that's right. The idea is that there is just a wave function of the universe. So, and that's this is what it is. So, are there other questions?
this is the Hilbert space with the delta functions. I mean, functions which are not really improperly Hilbert space, but that's not right.
No, it's the Hilbert space that you construct is the Hilbert space. It's the usual space of equivalence classes of square integrable complex functions on the configuration. Okay. So the path integral gives you what the textbook gives you, but it's also a foundation for a quantum theory of closed systems without needing to appeal to any external measuring apparatus. So as pointed out already by Dirac in 1932, when S over H bar is large, very small variations in the path produce very large variations in the phase, and therefore the contributions of paths which are close to each other will tend to cancel out, except when those paths are very close to a classical trajectory. So the only significant contribution to the path integral comes from paths very close to a classical path. And if the physical world corresponds to the histories that make the most contribution to the path integral, this would explain when and how classical physics approximates quantum physics. So that's already an argument made within a closed quantum system. There's no appeal to classical external measuring devices or observers. It's an argument that takes place within the quantum theory of the system alone. Okay. But it's very heuristic, right? So it's just a heuristic sketch of how classical behavior can emerge from a quantum theory. And the question is, what exactly is this correspondence? How do we make sense of this idea that the physical world corresponds to these trajectories in the sum over histories, which are close to the classical trajectories? So the rest of my talk is just a sketch of a framework for quantum theories founded on the path integral in which we're working towards answering this question. What is the physical world in a quantum theory? And towards making this heuristic argument of Dirac and Feynman rigorous. And let me just note that the answer to this question, what's the physical world in a quantum theory, depends crucially on kinematics. In other words, it depends crucially on the nature of the histories. The first thing that you have to do in a sum over histories theory is say what the histories are. And that's something which is part of physics. And it's not an easy part of physics. So for a non-relativistic particle, we're pretty sure that we have a good idea of what the histories that contribute to the sum over histories are. Actually, there's even work to be done in that regard, because we don't know, are those histories continuous histories? How continuous are they? Those sorts of questions are yet to be answered. But we have a pretty good idea that for a non-relativistic particle, the paths in the path integral should be something like particle-like trajectories. But what about quantum field theory? What about a fermionic quantum field theory? What are the histories in that case? That's answering that question is part of physics. So the path integral formulation of a quantum theory starts with an identification of what the histories are that go into the sum over histories. Okay, so where do we start to try to understand what the physical world is in a quantum theory based on the path integral? Well, one place to start is to notice that a path integral, the path integral for quantum mechanics is very, very similar in form to a particular classical theory. But it's not a classical Hamiltonian theory. It's actually a classically stochastic theory, and that theory is Brownian motion. Brownian motion is a is a, it's a continuum version of a random walk. So let's, just as a simple example, let's think about a random walk. And because we've been working in one dimension, let's just work in one dimension for a one-dimensional random walk. And let's discretize it as well. So it's a random walk on the integers. Okay, so 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. And let's discretize time as well. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. So a random walk, let's start the random walker off here. So the random walker has to step to the left or the right at every stage, say. You can make more complicated rules. And let's say it can only make one step to the left or right at each stage. And there's some probability for each possibility. So let's say it steps here, and then steps here, and then steps back there, and then steps here, and ends up here. Okay, so there's a certain weight for this particular path, and that weight is just the product of the probabilities for each of these steps. So for this path gamma, there's a certain weight. Let's call it A of gamma, that's its weight. And if we fix this initial position and this final position, then there will be a set of different paths that the walker can take, starting here and ending here. And let's call the set of all the paths that the walker can take omega. So gamma is some element of omega, and omega is a set of all possible paths that the walker can take from here to here. Okay. So there's a certain structure here. We have a set of possible space-time trajectories. We have weights. And for each, and we also have the notion of event. So the notion of what is an event? An event is something like the walker passes through, arrives at the point 2, at the position 2, at some time during the walk. All right, that's an event. And what it is equivalent to is some subset, I'll call it A, of the set of all histories. So let's think about that event. The event is that the walker reaches the position 2 at some time during the walk. Okay. So you take the set of all possible histories, and the set A is the collection of histories in which the walker does indeed arrive at position 2 at some time. And the histories outside A, those are all the histories in which the walker never reaches position 2. Okay. And there will be other events. B could be the event that on the first step, the walker steps to the right. Okay, so that's another event. It's the set of all histories in which the walker steps to the right on the first step, and then does whatever anything else after that. So subsets of the samples of the history space are we call events, and that's a standard terminology in stochastic processes. The other thing to say about an event is that it's associated to a space-time region. So the event B was, does it step to the right at the first stage? And so to decide whether a particular trajectory gamma is in the set B or not, you just have to look at its property here at position 1 at time t1. So you look at the property there, and you can decide whether it's in B or not. So the event B is located in space-time here. The event A that I described actually is not localized in time, because the event A was, does it reach the position 2 at any time? So A is not localized in time, but B is. Okay. So are there any questions about that sort of general framework of histories, a set of histories omega, events which are subsets of the of the set of histories omega. Okay. And then what else, the other thing that you have for a random walk is for each event, like B, right? So B is this event. We have a measure, mu, of B, and that's equal to the amplitude of each element of B summed over all B. So you recognize that, that's just the probability of that particular event, B. It's just the sum of the probabilities of all of the individual histories that are elements of that event. Okay. So that structure is very, is generic to all classical stochastic theories, which are physical theories of a system in space-time. So every classical stochastic theory in space-time has this structure. There is a set omega of possible space-time histories, so sequences of outcomes of 1,000 coin tosses, Brownian paths, or trajectories for a random walker. There is an event algebra, it's Boolean, and it's a subset of the set of all of the power set of omega. An event is a sub an event, one of these an element of the event algebra is a subset of this set of all histories. And an event is associated to a space-time region. So for every event, there's some space-time region which is associated to it, such that to tell whether a particular history is in that event or not, you just have to look at the properties of that history in that space-time region. There's a measure on the event algebra, so every event has a non-negative number associated with it, which encodes the dynamics and initial conditions. So this mu is a non-negative number for each event, A, and it's the probability that the event happens or is affirmed in the physical world. And then the possible physical worlds are just elements of that, just single elements of the set of all histories. So a walker goes on one and only one walk. You don't know which one, it's stochastic, it's random. But after the universe has run its course, if the universe just was a single walker, then there would have been one particular walk. And so the physical world corresponds to a single history, one element of omega. All right, so quantum mechanical systems in a path integral framework have almost everything, almost the, all of the structure that a classical stochastic theory has. It has, so a quantum mechanical system in space-time has a set of histories, those are the ones that you sum over in the sum over histories. The set of histories omega, we'll call it the same, give it the same notation. And what those histories are, as I said, is part of determining that the set of histories is the is part of physics. So they're particle trajectories for ordinary particle quantum mechanics, they're field configurations for field theory, etc. There's also a Boolean algebra of events. So again, an event is exactly the same thing that it is in the classical case. An event is a subset of histories, and there will be a space-time region associated with each event. So, for example, in our single-particle quantum mechanics example, let me call the event delta the set of all paths that go through those go through these gates. Okay. So we had our gates delta 1 at time t1, delta 2 at time t2, delta 3 at time t3, etc. So let me call the set delta, the set of all histories, the event delta, the set of all histories which go through those gates. Okay, that's an example of an event. Yes?
Is that an event is just a path at a particular point in space? It doesn't refer to momentum or energy or anything?
It's always position, yeah, for the particles, yeah. For quantum field theory, it would be something like, well, the average, say a scalar field, the average of the scalar field in over this particular space-time region is between, you know, 5 and 10 or something. So depending on what your theory is and what the histories are, the events will be different sorts of things, but they're always grounded in properties of the histories, right, which are space-time properties. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
The classical thing, that's a probability, right?
Yes, it's a probability.
But here, the analogous thing would be the amplitude and the complex.
The analogous thing is the square of the amplitude. Oh, so let me get onto that now. So as well as having a set of histories and an algebra of events, just as there is in the classical case, there is also a measure, mu. So for every event, there's a non-negative number. What is that non-negative number? I'll tell you what it is in a minute. But it also, just as it does in the classical case, encodes the dynamics and the initial conditions. Okay, so I'll say a bit more about the measure in a minute. And then four, in the classical case, possible physical worlds were elements of the set of histories. So now the possible physical worlds are, well, what? That's the question. We could postulate that the possible physical worlds are, again, just single histories. So for particle quantum mechanics, it's just one trajectory of the particle. That's a possible physical world. What I'm going to show you, hopefully, only about 10 minutes left, is that postulate is... fails. You cannot have, you cannot maintain the view that a possible physical world in quantum mechanics is a single history, it seems. Okay, so let's go to the measure. So in a classical stochastic theory, this measure is indeed a probability measure. It's a non-negative number for every event. The measure of the whole of omega, the set of all the possible histories, is just one. And the measure satisfies the usual rules, usual sum rule that probability satisfies. So the measure of the disjoint union of two events, so A or B, is just the measure of A plus the measure of B. So mu is interpreted as a probability measure. It says that the physical world affirms that event. In other words, that event happens, or in other words, the real history, the one that actually happens, is in that event, is in that set, if with probability mu of A. Okay. What about the quantile measure? Well, the quantile measure is, so the dynamics and initial state are encoded in it, and it just is the same path integral that we had before. So mu of delta, where delta is this set of all the histories that go through these gates, is that same double path integral that we had before. So, sum over histories gamma primed in delta and gamma in delta weighted by this kernel. The measure is positive. Sorry, I should say it's non-negative. Sometimes it's zero. It's real. So in that sense, it's very much like the classical measure. But however, famously, it does not satisfy the Kolmogorov sum rule, as you will probably notice, have realized, because of interference. Mu does, however, satisfy a generalized sum rule for the disjoint union of three events. And one could say much more about that, but I won't do that today. So mu cannot be interpreted as a probability measure. It just doesn't satisfy the rules for being a probability. And so at this point, we come to another fork in the road. So having chosen the Lagrangian, the relativistic branch of relativistic path in the of Dirac's fork, we come now to another choice, another fork, another place where you would go in different directions depending on different points of view. Yeah.
The kernel, have you Wickard meter? Or is that complex value and you can just prove somehow that measure?
Oh, this is complex.
Yeah, that's complex. Yeah,
yes.
Microcated it then.
No, okay. It's complex, yeah. But it's her mission. That's it. Yeah. So that's why this thing is okay. That's why this thing is real. Okay. So what is this fork? Well, there are the two paths that you can take that are known as by the following titles. So one approach is called decoherent histories, associated with Jim Hartle, and recently Gell-Mann and Hartle have written about it. And the second approach goes by the name of quantum measure theory and is being developed by Raphael. Okay, so here's decoherent histories in one slide. So if you believe that the Kolmogorov sum rules are necessary to use a measure scientifically, that if we need the probability sum rules to do science, then you have decoherent histories is the route to take. We need the sum rules, that's the assumption, and therefore we must restrict the events and the event algebra to some subalgebra on which the sum rules hold. So what you do is you partition the set of all histories omega into, you make a partition of the set. So here's omega. And you partition it. So here's E1, E2, E3. Such that the sum rules do hold for these sets of histories, E, E alpha. So mu of E alpha union E beta is just mu of E alpha plus E beta when alpha and beta are different. And the partition must be maximally fine-grained, meaning you can't divide one of these E's again and still have this sum rule hold. Okay, then you interpret mu. Now mu satisfies the usual probability sum rules on this subalgebra. So you, on the subalgebra generated by these events, you interpret it just as a probability. The physical world then is one of these sets, E alpha. It's not a single history, but a coarse-grained history. Okay. To take this route, you then have to struggle with the fact that there are many such partitions. So you can partition omega in this way and have the sum rules hold on this on these sets. And there will be a completely different partition. So this will be, say, F1, F2, F3, and F4, totally different, and having nothing to do with the first one, which on which the sum rules also hold. Yes.
Do you already know that these partitions even exist?
Yes, I can give you examples. So, in fact, if I have time, there's an example at the end of my talk.
So is this similar to saying that you could describe your wave function in position space or momentum space, or is it a different thing?
It has the same flavor, but here everything is position. So it's kind of analogous to that, but it's...
So you're saying the position is somehow built into this?
Yes, position is built for quantum mechanics. Position is built into it because the path integral is over trajectories in space-time. Yeah.
Could you say that an actual measurement device selects one of these decompositions? So in a way, this non-uniqueness is the kind of price you pay for not having a measurement device in your theory?
You mean a measurement device external to the theory?
Yes, which probes either the one decomposition or the other, its outcomes, for example. That would probably select one of these.
Yes, that's right. So if you go back to Copenhagen and you say, well, we've got classical measuring devices, then those classical measuring devices will tell you which partition you should be studying. So yeah. But for a closed system in which there's no external measuring devices, these are all these different partitions are on the same footing. So, yeah. Five. Yeah. All right. So that's one route. That's decoherent histories route. But there's another route. And the other route is to say we don't need the Kolmogorov sum rules. All we really need in science is a notion of preclusion. And I think this term preclusion appeared, I'm familiar with it first from a paper of Bob Garoch. So the notion of preclusion is that we predict that an event won't happen, typically, if it has zero or very small measure. And this preclusion, rule for prediction appears in Kolmogorov's book on the basic concepts in probability theory as principle B. So if this is right, if preclusion is all you need to make predictions in science, then you don't need the sum rule. You just need a notion of zero or small. Well, to take this route, it's not an easy route. You still have to struggle, but the struggle here is different from the struggle that faces you in the decoherent histories approach. The struggle here is that, firstly, that there's subjectivity in this notion of approximate preclusion. How small does the measure have to be before you predict that something doesn't happen? I'm not going to say anything about that. But the second struggle I'm going to say something about, which is that there are too many events of measure zero. So if we're setting the problem of approximate preclusion and how small is small enough aside, even if you restrict your predictions to predictions that the prediction that an event of zero measure doesn't happen, then you have something to face. All right. So, how many minutes?
Three.
Okay. So I'm not going to have time to tell you about the most interesting and example. So I'm just going to tell you a very simple example, which some of you may have seen before because Rafael has, I think, talked about it. However, if you would like, afterwards I can tell you about the more interesting one, which is based on the GHZ state, which is it's really sweet and lovely. Okay, so here's the three slit example of Raphael. So it's very simple. It's a post-selected three slit experiment. And if we call the three slits, so there's some source here, if we call the three slits A, B, and C, the particle can take three possible trajectories through, and we post-select on this position here on the final on the screen, this final position. And we can set things up so that the amplitude of this history is plus one, the amplitude of this history is minus one, and the amplitude of this history is plus one. And then if you calculate the measure mu of the event, which is AB, that's equal to zero, because you just add up the amplitudes and square it, that's zero. And the measure of the set BC is also equal to zero. And if you think about, so here's omega, it only has three histories in it, A, B, and C. The set AB has measure zero. The set BC has measure zero. And that means that no single history can correspond to the real world. If you take the usual point of view that if an event contains the real history, then that event is affirmed. So AB can't happen, BC can't happen, and that means that history A cannot happen, history B cannot happen, and history C cannot happen. So no, the physical world cannot be a single history. Now this example is not quite totally conclusive because you're post-selecting on this final position. There are other positions that the particle can end up in. But there are examples in the one I was going to show you, which I won't because it will take too long, based on the GHZ state, is an example where all of the possible histories for a system are contained within some event of measure zero. Okay.
So what does GHZ stand for?
Greenberger, Horn, and Zeilinger. Is that right?
What is it?
Chair, can I?
Yeah.
Yes?
Just as one.
So the GHZ state is a state of three spin half particles. And it's the superposition of the spin of all of the particles being up in the z direction plus all of the particles being down in the z direction. And you can, there's a beautiful, based on it, you can prove it's a sort of beautiful mixture of being a Bell type theorem and a Koch and Specker type theorem all in one. So it's a lovely thing. So, but it will take about 10 minutes, so I can tell you after. All right, so one history happens and preclusion are in conflict with each other. So we can either change one or the other or both. And I won't say anything except that we are working on proposals for what the physical world can correspond to. If it can't correspond to a single history, what does it correspond to? And we're being guided by these ideas that whatever the physical world is in a quantum theory, it should give us the result that it's a single history when the measure is classical. So we'd like to reproduce the classical case when the measure is classical. It should give classical answers about macroscopic events. It should give the Born rule for repeated quantum experiments. It should, we would like it to allow the physical world to evolve. And we'd like it also to throw light on relativistic causality for closed systems. And I will not go through those because I gave my conclusions at the end, at the beginning of the talk, so I'll end there. Thanks.
Questions? Why is there three slits different than two slits? I mean, two slits, you have the two of each one of them produces a point, that the other one produces a point, and both do not produce. So it's like an inverse. In some sense, it's the same. How is it different?
Yes, it's interesting. You somehow don't see, you don't see the full strangeness of quantum theory within the double slit experiment. So Feynman said that he claimed that the double slit experiment contained everything essential about quantum theory. Well, that's not the case. Because of the Bell theorem, that contains something essential about quantum theory that's not revealed by the double slit experiment. But even before that, the double slit doesn't reveal this particular aspect of quantum theory, that you cannot maintain this one history happens view of the physical world in a quantum theory, and you can't see that in the double slit experiment.
We see
this. I feel like we should let people let people go if they would like to go. So, but yes, I can show you that. It's so great. You'll like it. Okay, so let me. Many of you will know this little example of a Bell type. Koch and Specker type proof, but let me go through that just in ordinary quantum theory first, and then I'll show you how to mirror it within a sum over histories framework. So what's the GHZ theorem? Well, you notice that this state is an eigenstate of four operators, four observables, and those observables are, I'll call them x1, x2, x3 and x4. So x1 is spin, so I'll call spin, what shall I call that? S, spin of particle 1 in the x direction, times spin of particle 2 in the y direction, times spin of particle 3 in the y direction. And then these other two are the same as this, but you choose the x spin to be for particle 2 and particle 3. So this is x spin for particle 2, this is x spin for particle 3, and then y spin for the other two. So sy, 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 sy. 1, 3. Okay. And then this is x spin for all three. Okay, and to get rid of factors of h bar over 2, let's multiply this by what? Let's divide it by h bar 2 cubed, something like that. Okay, so x1 acting on psi. So x spin just flips up to down and down to up. Y spin flips but multiplies by I or minus I. And so this turns psi into minus psi. And x2 turns psi into minus psi. And x3 turns psi into minus psi. And x4, x spin just flips all of these down and flips all of those up. So x4 acting on psi is plus psi. So psi is an eigenstate of all of these observables. So if measurements merely reveal the values of the variables that are already there, if a measurement does what you think measurement should do, like if measurement means measurement, if you see what I mean, right? If a measurement just reveals the values that these variables already have, and whether or not you do the measurement, then the products of these spin values must be given by these numbers. Okay, so let's think now about, instead of being operators, let's think now about let's think about spin values. So I'll call them V. All right, so we've got V x1, V y2, V y3 must be the product of these numbers. Each one is a plus or minus h bar over 2. Must be minus, is negative, is minus 1. I'll absorb this thing, this normalization into here, so that the product of these is 1, is minus 1. And similarly, Vy1, Vx2, Vy3 is minus 1. And Vy1, Vy2, Vx3 is minus 1. But Vx1, Vx2, Vx3 is plus 1. Okay. Now, you multiply these four equations together, and you find that everything on the right-hand side is squared. You'll have Vx1 times Vx1, so it's Vx1 squared, Vy1 is squared, so everything is squared on the right-hand side, but the product of the left-hand, on the left-hand side, the product of the right-hand side is minus 1, so you get a contradiction. Okay, so that's the usual formalism of the GHZ. So you can make a path integral version of this antinomy in the following way. So you have your three particles, and you send them out in different directions along three different wings of an experiment to three different labs. So they do this. So particle 1 goes there, particle 2 goes there, and particle 3 goes there. And in lab 1, the particle is sent through a beam splitter, so some Stern-Gerlach apparatus, which splits the beam according to the X spin, right? But coherently, and then it recombines the beam. So it gets split into two beams here, coherently, but then is recombined again. So no measurement is done. It's just split and then recombined coherently in the X direction. So this is an X beam splitter. And let me call this beam plus and this beam minus. So if the spin is up in the X direction, it goes through this beam. If the spin is down, it goes through that beam. And then you send it through a Y beam splitter and recombiner. So this one is Y plus minus. And you do the same thing for the other three. So there's, I'll just draw it like this. So this is X and Y, plus and minus, plus and minus. And similarly for particle three, that goes through an X splitter, X plus and minus, and then a Y splitter, plus or minus. Okay. So in this setup, there are 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 to the 6 possible histories. So the sample space has 2 to the 6, which is 64 histories in it. And one history is a specification of which path particle one goes through and which path particle two goes through and which path particle three goes through. So it's a 6-bit string. So it's a plus or minus here, 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 plus or minus here. So there are 64 6-bit strings. Those are the histories. And corresponding to each of these four observables, there is an event, which I'll use the same terminology. X1 is the set of all histories such that the beams or the bits disagree with the quantum prediction. In other words, so X1 says that the product of the X spin of one with the Y spins of the others must be negative, right? So if you take those three bits from a particular history, then that product of those bits is either positive or negative. The plus or minus that labels the beams is either positive or negative. And the quantum prediction is that it's negative. So we put all the histories in which it's positive into this set here. And the same mass that leads to that, gives you that quantum prediction, shows you that the quantum measure, if you calculate the path integral for x1, is equal to 0. And similarly, if you define the set 2, x2, that's the set of all histories in which the values which label the beams in which the particles go through disagrees with the quantum prediction, that measure is also 0, etc. So you can say that mu of xi is equal to 0. So I equals 1 to 4. However, these sets cover the whole sample space. They cover the whole of the history space. So here's omega. And they do it in a pretty way. So here's x1, here's x2, here's x3. Here's x1, x2, and x3. And x4 is, what is x4? X4 is everything out here. And I think these bits. I'm not too sure about that, but anyway, the four events of measure zero, their union is the whole sample space. So again, no single history can happen because every single history is in one of these precluded events. That's the example. Are there other questions? I should mention that this Gell-Mann, something I didn't mention because I didn't have time, was that Jim, Gell-Mann and Hartle wrote a paper recently in which they put forward a one history happens, one real history is the physical world interpretation. And it falls foul of this GHZ example. It's just not viable because of this GHZ example.
I mean, it's weird in other ways, isn't it? They have negative probabilities
yes.
in their histories, and it's not quite clear what they do with that.
They do.
So
yeah.
It's not quite clear. I mean, if you're willing to break the rules in that way, it's not quite clear whether it's going to run into trouble. You know,
yeah. Although, if you believe in preclusion, it doesn't matter whether the measure is. Doesn't, yes, could be complex. So, I mean, yeah.
More questions?